Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from downtown Jersey City in that great state we know of as New Jersey. I'm so glad to be here. Have a great show for you this evening. Thanks for spending your time with me. The topic tonight is robots. Now, over the last few weeks, or maybe we could say a few months, the conversation in the tech industry has been all about AI, these large language models, and ChatGPT, and what OpenAI is doing, and how Google is trying to catch up, because since OpenAI did it, then Google has to shove out their mediocre version, warts and all. And so we've been watching that drama, that opera unfold. And there is another topic that is really taking shape, and that's robotics, that is only getting occasional coverage. Maybe because it's easier to talk about large language models. It's easier to play AI-generated music on the radio or on podcasts. It's a lot harder to play a robot, you know, to say, oh, let me describe what's happening. It's harder to describe, at least on a radio show. So I wanted to carve out an episode where we're just going to talk about robots this evening. And I think you're going to see that there are more developments happening in this area than you expect. And there are robots coming in all areas of life and work and services like education and healthcare. They're coming, and they're coming faster than you would expect. So my guest this evening is Eve Harold. She's written a book called Robots and the People Who Love Them. And we're going to talk about love robots as well, if that's where your first thought went to. What, the people who love robots, is it that kind of robot too? Yeah, we're going to talk about that too. All kinds of robots. They're all emerging and infiltrating our different moments of our lives, as I said. So we're going to talk robots, and then I think I'm going to have a few minutes afterward where I have a little more to say about a related matter about robots. But first, let's get to this interview. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments, and you can join in. If you're listening to an archive or podcast version of this show in the future, just go to tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the playlist link for the April 22, 2024 show. And you can see links to Eve and Eve's book and all the comments from tonight. And also I have some, somewhat amusing images on the playlist for your delectation as we listen to this interview. Let's go ahead and listen now to my conversation with Eve Harold here on Tectonic on WFMU. Eve Harold, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you on the show, Eve. I'm excited to talk about your new book, Robots and the People Who Love Them, Holding On to Our Humanity in an Age of Social Robots. This is a book about robots that are designed for some sort of relationship with humans. Now, whether the relationship is genuine or not, we'll get into that in a minute. But first, I thought we could start with the robots themselves. What sorts of so-called social robots exist today, and who are they meant for?
There are several on the market now that are available. A lot of them are geared towards children, you have robotic dogs like Aibo. Some of them are also geared towards elderly people who have dementia specifically. They're kind of like service animals, only they're not real, but they do have a soothing effect on some older people in nursing homes. They're being used. There's also a robot called Pepper, which is pretty well known social robot that has can do a lot of things. Isn't really as useful as it could be because it's on wheels, so it doesn't navigate a home very well. And then there's another one called Nao, NAO, and you can download onto these robots, these existing robots, all kinds of programs that are like, for example, exercise programs, conversational. They can be conversational. They can lead you in exercise. They can be caregiving. They can do caregiving to a great extent. We can talk a little bit more about that later, I hope. But then you have some like ultra realistic social robots like Sophia, made by Hanson Robotics in Hong Kong, and Amica, which are kind of a little spooky. In my opinion, I think they kind of are hovering on the edge of the uncanny valley. But there's all kinds of robots, social robots being developed in academia and in companies, robotics companies across the world.
And this is just the beginning, right? I mean, you've listed a number of categories of robots and some of the examples, but that's where we are today. I mean, we should probably expect to see a profusion of new robots and new types of robots in coming years, right?
Well, there's no question about it. And the thing is that robots are going to be moving into the consumer space more than ever. Right now, you have price is a bit of an obstacle, but with kind of the way things work economically, over time, the technology goes up, the price goes down. So I think we're really looking at a near future. When consumer robots will be on the market that are actually a lot more able than people think. They can do a lot of things, but the technology is moving forward at just an incredible pace. So, when I was researching and writing this book, the innovations, it was hard to stay on top of them all. So I tried to, when I wrote the book, I tried to focus on what the more enduring, subjects are in terms of how we as human beings will be affected by these robots and how our culture will be affected.
As I read the book, I was trying to wrap my arms around the sheer diversity of the robots that are available today, and as you say, the ones that are in the pipeline right now being designed for release to the consumer market soon enough. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but my first draft was to put them into two buckets. On the one hand, you have robots that are designed for a specific therapeutic purpose. They're here to help a certain population that has a well-defined need. Okay, so you mentioned the caregiving robots that are at some nursing homes right now. We have seniors, maybe they are suffering from dementia, and the research has shown that some of these robots can have some use, which you can talk to. So there's a narrowly focused use case for that first bucket of robots. And then in the second bucket, you have these more general purpose robots where the companies are claiming and or hyping all sorts of possible outcomes, and they're promising the world, this is going to be your new companion. They're going to be a friend. They're going to get to know you. I mean, the hype really talks about these robots in terms of a conscious sentient being. Those are very different from the therapeutic robots. How does that sound to you as a categorization?
I think that's a useful way to categorize them. The robots that I spend, and obviously there are robots that can help with different therapeutic purposes, and we can talk about that a little later. But the robots that I focus on through most of the book are robots that literally are being designed to display social and emotional traits. And you would think that, okay, a relationship with a robot, that's kind of silly. I would never fall for that. Unfortunately, the research shows something very, very different. So we all have emotional and social hardwiring, and there are cues that will trip the wire and create a response in us. And it's irresistible, facial expressions. There's something like six facial expressions that humans globally, regardless of culture, recognize and respond to. And robots are being created to have those expressions, to respond to your own emotions. They can read your body language. They can read the tone of your voice and respond with what is hopefully an appropriate response that gets into the kind of social emotional side of things. And research has shown that people get very, very seduced and attached to these robots very easily. There's a psychologist at MIT. Her name is Sherry Turkle. She's spent years studying children's interaction with animal robots and finding that, there's a whole psychological trend that develops over time when you're dealing with a robot, and that is that the robot, because it remembers everything you say to it, it learns everything it can about you, it reflects that back to you, can become very exquisitely fine-tuned to your personality and your interests. People get really sucked into this, because robots are not demanding. They're designed to please you in every way. So they're far more addictive and seductive than we would think at first glance.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do, or I should say, it has little to do with how anthropomorphic it looks. You talk about not just robots for kids. You can think, well, kids will anthropomorphize their dolls. They've done that forever. And so a walking, talking, personality reflecting doll, this robot, of course, would a kid would get attached to that. But on the other hand, you write late in the book about bomb disposal robots that are used by military forces. And can you talk about the attachment that these soldiers that they've developed for those robots?
Yeah, so it's really fascinating because these robots are very utilitarian looking. I don't know if you've ever looked at some of the robots made by Boston Dynamics that are being used by the military. Some of them are very, if you just look at them as they're motionless, you would think that's very utilitarian. I could never get attached to that. But when you look at them in motion and you see them doing things that appear to be intelligent and they stand between you and severe injury, if not death, on a daily basis, soldiers tend to get very attached to these robots. And they give them names, they give them backstories. They a lot of times name them after a favorite girlfriend. When they get destroyed, there have been military units that have given 21-gun salutes at the funerals of these machines. And even soldiers who are, of course, trained very, I mean, they have extensive training in remaining rational and trying to not get emotional and things like that. They get very attached to these robots. It's a very difficult thing to lose one, especially in an emotionally charged situation like that, where that robot is literally making you safe and going out and doing dangerous things that you now don't have to do yourself. So, yeah, it's a strong bond.
I can see that, and I should say I support bomb disposal robots. If that's going to keep people safe, that's a good thing. The flip side of that, though, is, and you write about this in the book, that companies that are making these robots for consumer use, now here I'm not talking about military forces, but a robot that would be at home with a child or someone of any age, the companies know that people form attachments. And as you say, that attachment can be addictive. The companies then design the robot in order to push those emotional buttons, in order to form as close a bond as it can with the user, with the consumer, for, and this is me opining here, but this fits with how tech companies have been making their apps and platforms addictive to users over the last several years. It's not for the long-term good of the consumer. It's for the profit motive and the growth at any cost mindset of the company. There was a very interesting research study that you talk about in the book. This is about a robot called BERT that researchers had set up to act in a certain way so that they could see how the human respondents in the test reacted. Can you talk about what happened with BERT?
Yeah, so BERT was tested out among something like, it was a small group of people, it was 20-something adults. The results were really surprising because they had BERT essentially applying for a job as a kitchen assistant. That was the context. And so they had three versions of BERT. You know, one of them was, you know, looked basically humanoid, you know, not terribly humanoid, but somewhat humanoid, and behaved perfectly, was very quick, very efficient, followed all the directions perfectly. And then they had another version of BERT. It did the same sort of things, but it didn't look as humanoid. You could see it's circuit boards and wiring and all that. And then the third BERT, which was BERT C. BERT C was a lot less efficient, but it was more emotional. So BERT C, when he was handed an egg, see, I'm saying he already, when it was handed an egg, it dropped the egg. And then it got a whole emotional reaction. Its face looked really, you know, downcast, and it looked upset. And then it asked, you know, let me try again. And so at the end of the little segment there, the little test, these robots would ask, so did I get the job? So what happened was the vast majority of the people in the study chose BERT C. They liked the robot that made a mistake, was a little more accessible, was more human-like, that had expressions and seemed, one of them even, they were taking some notes at the end of it, and it said that it felt that it was being emotionally blackmailed when BERT C asked if he got the job.
That's the part that I underlined as I was reading, that one of the respondents saw what was happening in the test, that BERT C had been designed specifically in order to elicit an emotional response from the respondents. As you write in the book, one participant even wrote, quote, emotional blackmail in his notes with the word blackmail underlined. And I thought, there's someone who's thinking about this the right way. I probably would have written something very similar.
Well, you actually really, I touched on something, Mark, when you mentioned social media, because social media is the first technology that actually engages with us emotionally. And I think the tech companies have learned a lot from that, that if you really want to reach people, you don't necessarily appeal to their intellect so much as you push their emotional buttons. And it's surprisingly and a little bit alarmingly easy to do that with people. Advertisers do it all the time. So, and robots will do the same thing.
Now, you write a little bit about AGI, artificial general intelligence, this idea that some of the tech companies and techies out there claim is actual sentience, this general purpose broad AI that can learn and can end up doing anything, you know, functioning in a household and then existing out in society, as opposed to just a narrow AI with a narrow set of well-defined skills. It's probably a little out of scope to get into the whole consciousness discussion here about whether AGI represents real consciousness. But I liked something that you wrote in that chapter. You wrote, some AI experts even argue that if a machine acts as though it has general intelligence, we will consider it sentient, whether it's conscious or not. And I thought that was exactly right. In other words, people can debate endlessly whether machines have achieved AGI, and if so, whether they have achieved real sentience, whether they actually have consciousness, that's an interesting philosophical discussion for another show. The point here is that it doesn't matter, because if people's emotional buttons are being pushed, as you say, it doesn't matter if the machine is conscious or not. I actually happen to believe none of these things are conscious or ever will be, but it doesn't matter. People will treat them as though they are conscious. They'll act as right. though the machines feel pain and emotions.
This is very, very true. And you even see it with some very, versed engineers who are working in AI with the robotics and in generative AI, who themselves are unsure. They seem a little confused themselves. Now, I'm with you. I don't think they're conscious now, and I don't think they ever will be unless there's some real qualitative leap in the abilities that we give them, not just more computational power, because computational power is one thing and we value it highly, but to equate with consciousness, it takes many different kinds of intelligence. So, but you're right. I mean, we will respond to them as though they were real, and even the most rational among us will be vulnerable to that. And these robots will take on a life of their own. And the concern that I have is that they may displace real human relationships. And I'm concerned about that because we're already displacing real face-to-face human relationships with social media and the technologies that we have today. Sherry Turkle, who I mentioned before, the psychologist, has observed the trend with children and young people, even up to the age of college age, who deal with a lot of mediated interaction. So interaction that's mediated by social media and technology. And what happens is that their real social skills start to atrophy. And they find it very comfortable to kind of recede into, you know, this kind of social rut where they're getting their little hits of serotonin from, you know, social media and from text. And these young people are loath to pick up a telephone and call someone because it becomes too much of an emotional risk. They don't believe they have the social skills to interact in a successful way. And on a level, they don't. And so I think robots will take that to a whole other level.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Eve Harold, author of the book Robots and the People Who Love Them. We're having a good discussion on the comment board. If you'd like to join in, go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Eve Harold here on Tectonic on WFMU. After all, this book is called Robots and the People Who Love Them, not the people who like them or use them or whatever. So you're asserting that there are people out there who love the robots. And in fact, you have a whole section on love robots, as you call them. Can you tell us what's happening in the world of love robots and the people who love them?
I did a lot of research on those people and that phenomenon because I felt that it was the best in terms of what research has been done and published and is available. You know, it was very insightful into what we can expect when love dolls, as they're called today, become very, very advanced, conversational, ultra realistic love dolls or sex dolls, if you want to call them that. They will be very captivating. And I think these relationships can be very problematic. If you look at men for example, who tend to form these deep associations or deep attachments to their love dolls, you see a ready-made market for sophisticated sex robots. There are ethical questions there. I mean, you can say, well, there are people who are very lonely, who don't have a chance of making a real connection with a real woman. And then, maybe this is not so bad for them. Maybe why, where's the harm, But you could also say, what about a married person having a sex robot? Is that going to be considered infidelity? As happens with the men with love dolls, is that they progress in the relationship. They graduate to the point where they would not even consider a relationship with a real woman. And you have to think that over time, these people are really missing something in life, that most of us find very fulfilling, if not, exasperating and crazy and all the rest of it. In the last analysis, they help us grow. And people who have these kind of dependent relationships with robots and dolls and artificial agents, they're not challenged to grow. They're not going to reassess their behavior because no one is asking them to. The robot certainly isn't asking them to. There are men also who have unfortunate proclivities sexually, that they would visit upon a robot. And I've puzzled over this a lot because, there's two sides of that coin as well. One side says, well, they're not doing it to prostitutes or real life partners. But then the other question is, how do we know they're not really carrying that behavior over into real relationships? The research hasn't been done. So it's an open question. Are people siphoning off bad behavior, or are they simply magnifying it and intensifying it so that they didn't carry it over into human relationships? We don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's well said, and that's indicative of a larger pattern here about what are we normalizing when we send these robots out, whether they're love robots or robots in the classroom or robots for kids or whoever is the intended audience. What is the kind of relationship, I'm using that in quotes, that we're normalizing? So, for example, you write about how a lot of robots, especially these love robots, are designed to be accepting of the user no matter what. Anything they say to them, anything they do to them is okay, and they only reflect back positivity. Well, that, as you just point out, possibly could lead to some very bad outcomes if people become accustomed to anything they say and do to another party, robot or person, they expect it to be reflected back as positive. And so all sorts of bad behavior could be encouraged. On the flip side of that, I could see the tech companies saying, well, what would you like us to do? Would you like us to start teaching the user how to behave? And you touch on this as well in the book in a couple of parts where, and I forget the exact examples, but there were a couple of cases where systems were expecting the user to be polite to the robot. In fact, just Eve, as a digression, I read about a research paper recently that the ChatGPT type chatbots that are out now, they deliver better answers if the user is polite to the chatbot, which is very disturbing to me. I mean, both sides of this coin are very disturbing to me. But if I just look at the second side, are we hoping that the tech companies will start to teach everybody how to properly behave with their robot or with their chatbot or whatever kind of bot? That I definitely don't want. There doesn't seem to be a good outcome in either case.
There actually are some instances in recent years of different professions outside of computer technology collaborating with scientists, like psychologists. There's a therapeutic bot. This is not embodied, but it's therapeutic, and it's called Wobot, Woebot. And it was developed at Stanford University with some engineers and some psychologists who turned it into a therapy robot or a therapy bot that actually delivers a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. I think if we were going to go in the right direction, that's the way to go. But I agree with you. I don't think we need, Silicon Valley to decide what is proper or appropriate behavior on the part of these robots. I'm not sure we have they have a clear fix on proper behavior amongst humans. So, it's something that needs to go beyond the engineering and the computer science sector. And again, you have to ask, is this really healthy? Again, because we're getting even more sucked in here. Maybe it's having a positive influence. I'll give you another example of a positive influence. Children with autism. There are autism programs that can be downloaded into robots like Pepper and Now, which I mentioned earlier, that interact very therapeutically with children with autism. So they will teach them things like Emotions 101, how to have a back and forth conversation, how to make eye contact, how to let the other person speak, how to just interact at a very fundamental level. And it seems to be helpful. I mean, the research so far shows that it does help with these children. Now, the thing is, this program will not take them all the way to the arena of human interaction. They need to take those basic skills and transfer them to the human world, to the real world. And I'm just not sure that the robot is going to tell them to do that. And I'm not sure that the parents who use these programs understand that they need to do that. So we need to have a pretty critical mind about all of this.
Well, I think that's a great example. You write quite a bit about the robots for autistic kids and the positive results they get up to a certain point through those interactions. As I read that, I was thinking, yes, it's positive up to a point. And then, as you say, Eve, it's time to leave the robot behind and start interacting with people where real, genuine relationships lie. Because it's not real. It may be therapeutic and helpful, but it's not real with a robot. So the problem is, find me a tech company, Eve, that is going to design their product for the user to stop using it at some point and to leave it behind.
It's not going to happen, in my opinion, because I mean, we're looking at an economic model here that, is the whole model is to create a product that people would depend on and continue to depend on, and to create demand. So no, I don't think the robotics companies are going to do that. I'm not sure who would tell us that in the society we have today. Who is going to tell us that? Let's keep this in context. Let's have a real perspective here on what robots are and what they're not, and how they can be used in a healthy way and how they can be misused in a very unhealthy way. Where is that message going to come from? I'm not sure myself.
I think a lot of this comes down to the underlying business model and how the organization is capitalized. If it's a for-profit company, especially those out on the West Coast that are organized for growth at any cost, no matter what, you can bet that any kind of robot that they create is going to be designed for continuous engagement. As you say, Eve, it's never going to be designed for someone to turn it off. I can imagine, on the other hand, that there could be nonprofits out there that are actually organized to help people. Here, I'm just really fantasizing. Could there be a nonprofit organization that creates robots that says, we are here to create technology, in this case, robots, to help someone get from point A to point B, and then we're going to encourage them to put the robot away? We are not growth at any cost. We are here for the long-term health and relationships and community of our users. Is there anything like that out there?
There isn't any, currently anything like that out there. I will mention the organization that I work for, which is a nonprofit called Healthspan Action Coalition, and our mission is to extend the human health span, not just longevity, to extend the lifespan, but healthy lifespan, healthy longevity. So I've written about this a bit in my newsletter, and I will continue to do so for the Healthspan Action Coalition. And we have the opinion that people really first need to know that this exists before it will ever enter any kind of mainstream conversation. We recognize that there are some very positive roles that robots can play in the realm of caregiving for older people who are trying to live alone, who want to age in place in their home. There are robots who can do all kinds of things for them, and including conversation, including the relationship skills, but they can do things like lift them from the bed and put them in a wheelchair and back. Help them dress, bathe them. There are a lot of things that robots can do in the realm of healthcare. But again, we've got to take this conversation out of academia and move it into mainstream, dialogue. And that's what I try to do with my book, is first of all, to make people aware that, this technology exists. And it's coming down the pike, and it's becoming more sophisticated by the day, and it has these issues. And if you're going to use it, sure, that's fine. That's great. Use it for what it's intended for, but keep it in perspective. Keep a bright line in your mind as much as you can between fantasy and reality, because your relationship with the robot is a fantasy, and it's a narcissistic fantasy. Because it's like an echo chamber, and you're getting your own tastes and desires reflected back to you. Keep that in mind. And also, we're going to have to start educating people young. And I almost feel like there's a role in the schools for this, to teach young people who will be dealing with robots all their lives, for sure. What's the demarcation line? When is it good? When does it start to veer off into, the wrong direction? We need to teach people that.
I wonder if we could also teach them how to destroy a robot if they ever need to. And of course, I'm half joking here, but I mean, I'm having this fantasy slash nightmare of a few years down the road, and I'm walking somewhere out on the street, and a robot approaches me. "Hello, I'm from Facebook. I'm a new robot. Would you be my friend?" And, I just have this visceral sense that I'm going to want to destroy that thing. Of course, I don't advocate anyone breaking the law, but I mean, are you worried at all? Because, Eve, listen, the companies that have all of the money right now to build the technology, they're not the Healthspan folks, all right? It's the Facebooks and the Googles and the Apples. Those are the ones that are most prominent and are most likely to build the robots that push all of the emotional buttons and are spreading all through society and asking us to be their friends. And I'm going to want to know, what do you got to do? Do you got to squirt them with a water bottle, or do you have to use magnets, or do we just go old school with a sledgehammer?
Oh, that's funny. I think that you're probably not alone, because there's plenty of people out there who really kind of do have have misgivings about the role of technology in our lives, and how prominent it's becoming, and how much more mediated our experience with life is with different technologies. And you're right, the people who are going to design and sell the robots to you are never going to tell you, "This thing has gone, psychopathic, destroy it." But it's going to have we're going to have to ride that wave. We're going to have to get to the point where people have enough familiarity with these robots to even know what we're talking about in terms of the downsides of those relationships. And that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what the Healthspan Action Coalition is helping me try to do. And so, we'll have to do it, but we're at the very beginning of this, and unfortunately, it's like I think it's going to be similar to social media. Okay, or the internet. Let's take that as an example. I remember in the 90s when the internet was a gleam in all of our eyes, and people were saying, "What's the point? What do we need that for? That's just, I can't see the point. I would never use that." Anyway, well, it turns out, 20 years later, 30 years later, people are literally addicted to it. And I think it's going to be a progression like that with robots, where people are going to go into it think very naively, thinking, oh, this is the latest thing. It'll be fun. It'll be entertaining. And it will be fun and entertaining. And it'll take them down a road where they become more and more dependent on them and less dependent and intertwined with the real relationships in their lives. So again, people will start at that point to think about this, and there will be studies done and papers written and longitudinal studies of how this progresses over time. And then we'll start to have some idea of how to use this. But again, I'm very passionate about needing to take this whole issue out of academia and out from behind the closed doors in Silicon Valley and into the light of the mainstream public consciousness.
Well, I appreciate you raising awareness about this, Eve. This is an important topic for us to get ready for. I'm not particularly looking forward to it, but it's something that we're better off knowing about, as you say. The book is called Robots and the People Who Love Them: Holding On to Our Humanity in an Age of Social Robots by my guest today, Eve Harold. Eve, thanks again for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 15 minutes of the show, and then Dave Mandel's going to show up with his show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show, and you should listen to it. Then we got Amanda and Jim the Poet. Jim's on the comment board. Hi, Jim. After Dave with Bad Animals. And then Brother Daniel Blumen shows up at 9 p.m. Eastern for his eponymous show, taking us all the way to midnight. So just stay tuned to WFMU, would you? I have some more comments on this interview and themes, but while I'm on the topic of WFMU, I want to remind everybody that the station is sending out the marathon swag. We just had our fundraising marathon a few weeks ago, and a bunch of people were so generous, and we are sending them their goodies, the CDs, the t-shirts, and everything else. And we just wanted to say thanks to all the volunteers who've been helping to package things up and helping us mail them out. Today, our volunteer was Greg, who did great work. Thank you, Greg, for helping out. And if you're waiting on your swag, it's coming. It's on its way. It may take a little while, but don't worry. We're working on it. And if you want to be one of the volunteers to help us package up the swag, you can contact Volunteer Whippersnapper Scott. His email is scott@wfmu.org. And by the way, my email, if you want to contact me about anything, is mark, that's M-A-R-K, at wfmu.org. All right. So let's talk about this interview. Thanks again to Eve Harold for speaking with me and talking about her book, Robots and the People Who Love Them. So many good themes in the interview that are also in the book, and a good overview of the kinds of robots that are out there, and some of the, I would say, limited upsides that are out there, and some of the downsides that are really not getting a whole lot of attention as we careen into this new age of robots everywhere. Of course, like many other past episodes, we're seeing yet another technology trend that is being driven by the same set of companies, the same enormous pile of money out in Silicon Valley that's all driven by the same ethos of growth at any cost. Surveillance, manipulation, control, exponential growth, and not a shred of ethics out there informing these decisions. And that's why we, the ones who are going to be impacted by all of this, we should start by gaining some awareness about what's coming at us. So there's so many things. I have 10 minutes. What can I say? I wanted to say something about the love robots, specifically the mention of Hatsune Miku, who is this holographic Vocaloid performer. I should say which. It's an algorithmically generated anime character that goes on stage, goes in front of thousands of people at these giant arenas, sellout crowds, both in Japan and in the U.S. and elsewhere, and this algorithmically generated anime character sings these songs and does these dances. I think there's some audience interaction in the form of them submitting different dances that the character can do. Anyway, this character is not just a popular character, you know, in some cartoon somewhere. The character draws crowds in real life and is presented as a hologram, as I say, on stage. So it looks lifelike, but I don't think anyone could mistake it for a human being or a real life performer. It's definitely a character. And I think, great, you know, somebody's into Hatsune Miku and wants to go to a concert. And I think it's a group experience of people all singing along. And that must be a lot of fun. That's cool. But a few years ago, I think in 2017 or 2018, there was a young man in Japan who was really, I mean, really into Hatsune Miku and decided to marry the character. Now, of course, everybody has access to the character. You can download videos or whatever. He had his own version of the character he had downloaded, and he decided to marry Hatsune Miku. And I have a little news report from a few years ago describing how this actually went down. Why don't we listen to that now? Again, this is from, I think, 2018.
I now pronounce you man and virtual wife. A 35-year-old man in Japan has decided to give up his pursuit of finding the perfect woman, instead opting to marry a computer character who took on doll form for the sake of their wedding. His bride is Hatsune Miku. She's a virtual reality star in Japan with thousands of loyal fans. She was developed as a computer-generated singing software that resembles a 16-year-old anime pop star. Her creator, Krypton Future Media, declined to comment when approached by Reuters. They declared their love for each other in front of nearly 40 wedding guests this month in an $18,000 ceremony. Weeks after their vows, Akihiko Kondo is settling into married life. When he returns home in the Japanese suburbs, after work in a local middle school, a holographic projection of his bride welcomes him home.
Tadaima.
She can recognize his face and voice and is programmed to respond with simple phrases and songs. Hatsune Miku's projection was developed by Japanese tech developer Gatebox. Last year, they began issuing marriage registration forms. They're not official, but according to their website, nearly 4,000 of these so-called certificates have been downloaded. Kondo says some people have accused him of being a creepy otaku, which loosely translates to geeks who live an antisocial life. Others have accused him of contributing to Japan's declining population, while some have even accused him of stealing their pop star. But that doesn't faze Kondo, nor does the fact his parents didn't attend his wedding. He says he hopes his declaration of love to a trademarked character will inspire others to find marital bliss, in whatever form that might take.
And that was the news story about the Japanese man who married Hatsune Miku. And so, yes, and I think he's an edge case, but I think that gives you a sense of how far this can go, that people will perceive that they've developed real relationships with these algorithmically determined AI bots that are they're just a pile of computer code, really. And it has a real draw on people. I think one of the really important points that I took away from the conversation with Eve was that the question of whether the robots are really conscious or sentient is an interesting philosophical discussion, but in the end, it doesn't really matter because whether they're really conscious or not, it only matters if the user perceives them as conscious or conscious enough. They're going to start treating them as being conscious. There are stories from I think it's the robotics lab at MIT, and even in the early days, with very early stage robots, the graduate students did not like rebooting these robots because it would make their robot eyes open and close in weird ways, and it would look as though the reboot sequence was doing something painful to the robots, even though the graduate students knew very well that these robots were not conscious. They were just, silicon and metal and plastic and some computer code and electricity. That was it. The robots were perceived as just conscious enough that the grad students treated them that way. And if you can imagine, when we have a society full of these robots that are tuned to be manipulative of all of us, pushing our emotional buttons in order to gain our engagement in the same way that our addictive iPhone apps, Android apps are doing the same thing, we're going to be, I think, in some very strange and possibly very harmful territory. Another thing that I want to bring up is a recent piece of news from Boston Dynamics, and Webhamster Henry put a link to a Wired story on the comment board, and that is that the Atlas bot, this humanoid Atlas robot that they always had dancing to choreographed dance routines to these pop songs. They had Boston Dynamics. It used to be owned by Google. Now it's owned by Hyundai, the auto manufacturer. Atlas has been sunsetted. There is no more Atlas robot. Sort of, because Boston Dynamics is no longer making the old version of Atlas. They have started making a new version of Atlas, and it's worth finding online a 40-second video released just a few days ago by Boston Dynamics showing what the new Atlas looks like and what it does. It is humanoid in a way, but when you see its head spinning around, Exorcist style, and when you see the joints going around 360, it looks to me, it looks vaguely demonic. I mean, it certainly looks sinister what this robot can do. And the Wired article echoes that apprehension. If you read the Wired article that's linked from the comment board, the author is similarly saying this does not look great. And in fact, what I found interesting was that the Boston Dynamics, the promotional video of the new Atlas bot, there's no music. There's no choreography. There is no attempt to make this thing look friendly or endearing. It just spins its head around and stands up, stares at you, and then marches off. And it comes across as a warning more than anything else. And I hope that this conversation serves as not so much a warning, but a wake-up call to all of us that there are going to be some changes afoot and we should be on our guard for the emotional blackmail that these robots are going to be bringing and the exploitative business models of the companies that are behind the robots. We have to keep our attention on those. So, yeah, I don't think we should be making friends with these things. I think we need to be on our guard against the latest predatory attempt from Silicon Valley to own our lives and everything in the economy, and it's worth resisting. That's about all the time I have for us this evening. You have been listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, at 91.9 FM and online at wfmu.org. Until next time, friends, I've got a little homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And hey, listen, when you go to the beach, you put on your sandals, but right now the next show is Dave Mandel's, and I want you to stay tuned for that. And our outro this evening is a little bit of the new Tectonic Premium. I haven't played any of this. This is the world premiere on WFMU of Hurst and Otsk singing a song called Spam Eater. And for those of you who got the Tectonic Premium, you're going to be able to hear this yourself pretty soon when this swag arrives, which is coming. Anyway, hope you have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time.
And as the members of Yes file out of the studio, it's time for me to introduce another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music presented by me, Dave Mandel, here at WFMU every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Thank you for joining me this evening. Great to be here, always. We are going to start tonight's show with some music from France. It's a group called, I've never heard their name said out loud. I guess it would be pronounced Zal, X-A-A-L. And I think it's an abbreviation. Well, I'm not sure what it stands for, but it's all caps, okay? X-A-A-L is the way the name of this band is styled. We're going to hear a track from a 1995 album released on the Musea label, a French label. I've mentioned them, I think, many times over the years, over the year. Best known, I would say, for prog music, prog rock, and reissues of great prog records, excellent label, Musea. So that alone, this comes recommended for that reason alone. Anyway, Zal, this is, you know, they're kind of more of a jazz fusion. They tend to be grouped in, categorized as a Zul group, and I won't go into what that means again because I think I did at length last week, but they're generally considered a Zul band, but they're kind of jazzy, more jazzy, a little less proggy, less hardcore proggy than most Zul groups. Anyway, enough of that. This will be a track called Force from the band Zal.